For centuries, humanity has celebrated its genius, from unlocking the secrets of DNA to walking on the moon. But now, science has turned its gaze to something far smaller, yet infinitely powerful. Tiny, invisible creatures, long dismissed as mere nuisances, are stepping into the spotlight. They're here to reveal that everything and everyone is connected. And more than that, that they, the microbes, may have been the ones calling the shots in the evolution of life all along. Get ready to explore the extraordinary world of the gut microbiome and its profound connection to the human brain, where each discovery is driving medicine to unprecedented breakthroughs and asserting revelations that could change the way we understand ourselves forever.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about guts. And today, I thought it was about time to talk about the gut microbiome and the gut-brain axis. And so I have the honor of co-hosting today's episode with one of the world's best neurosurgeons. Since 2007, he has been head of department of the neurosurgery and pediatric neurosurgery at the Charité University Hospital in Berlin, Germany. He is responsible for the management of 5,000 brain surgeries per year, 800 of which he performs himself. Professor Petr Bajkocsi. I'm so honored. Thank you, Petr, for agreeing to co-host this episode with me. Welcome.
Ceci, thank you so much. I'm very much looking forward to talking to our guest today. And I bet our audience will want to know who he is.
Our guest today is Professor John Cryan, Vice President for Research and Innovation at University College Cork, UCC, Ireland, and Professor in the Department of Anatomy and Neuroscience and Principal Investigator at APC Microbiome Ireland Institute. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry and a PhD in Pharmacology from the University of Galway. He's held postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Pennsylvania, USA, and the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, and is visiting fellow at the Department of Psychiatry, University of Melbourne, Australia. He spent 4 years as a group leader in the pharmaceutical industry before returning to academia in 2005. His groundbreaking research focuses on the gut-brain axis and how gut microbes influence stress, psychiatric and immune disorders, and their impact on mental health, positioning him as a leading figure in his field with numerous influential publications and significant contributions to scientific research and public understanding of the microbiome. He has published over 600 peer-reviewed articles and co-edited several books, notable the best-selling The Psychobiotic Revolution, Mood, Food, and the New Science of the Gut-Brain Connection. In addition, Professor Cryan is Editor-in-Chief of Neuropharmacology and of Neurobiology of Stress and serves on the editorial boards of 15 other scientific journals. He has received numerous awards for his significant contributions, including UCC Researcher of the Year and Research Communicator of the Year, the University of Utrecht Award for Excellence in Pharmaceutical Research, the Data Prize from FASEB, and the Tom Connor Distinguished Scientist Award from Neuroscience Ireland. He's also been listed in the Clarivate Analytics Highly Cited Researchers every year since 2017 and was elected a Fellow of the Royal Irish Academy in the same year. a recipient of the Research Mentor Award from the American Gastroenterology Association, Professor Cryan has also been awarded an honorary degree from the University of Antwerp, Belgium, and has been a TEDMed and TEDx speaker.
Welcome, Professor Cryan. We're thrilled to have you here today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for the invite.
Good morning, John. Pleasure to be with you.
Good morning, Peter.
The fact that the brain is physically connected to another part of the body may seem logical today, but what surprises me most is the emotional interaction between these two organs, between the more rudimentary basic gut and what we thought was the more sophisticated part of the human body. And finally, the relationship between the microbiome and social behavior. To see what's happening in science and medicine right now, it is just mind-blowing. Isn't that amazing, Peter?
Yes, indeed. It's fascinating how our understanding of microbiology and bacteria has changed in the last decade. John, could you help us understand exactly what microbes are?
Yes, Peter. Microbes is a general term for all of these tiny organisms that we cannot see with our naked eye. These include the bacteria, the viruses, the fungi, archaea, etc. And as you say, they are becoming to be much more appreciated beyond just simple germs.
I think the next logical question would be, what is the gut microbiome and how is it made up?
So within our gut, then we have trillions of microorganisms. So predominantly we think of the bacteria, but it's not just bacteria. It's also the viruses, the bacteriophages, these viruses that are very much there to keep the bacteria at bay. Various fungi, archaea, single cellular organisms that we have in our gut that are really important for helping to educate our immune system and playing a key role in maintaining what we call homeostasis.
And now the question that one of our guests in this season, the distinguished historian and academic Dr. Elsa Richardson, specialized in intersection of medical and cultural history, left for you.
Hello, my name is Elsa Richardson and I have a question for Professor John Cryan. How has your research into the gut-brain axis shifted your understanding of intelligence? As a neuroscientist, I would assume that intelligence, for you, might be something primarily understood in relation to the workings of the brain, firing neurons, neural pathways, and so on. But has your research into the gut and its microbiome changed how you view intelligence?
Well, that's a great question. And we think of intelligence in terms of its cognitive function in general. And over the past two decades, we've had a complete new way of looking at how we can influence aspects of fundamental neurobiological aspects of cognitive function by the gut microbiome. And in terms of this being a shift, I think so, because in neuroscience and intelligence research in particular, people are very focused on what happens from the neck up. But now, reframing the question around how microbes in the lumen of the gut can actually send signals to your brain and affect higher cognitive function across the lifespan is really beginning to challenge us as to really what is the brain doing and how it's working in its most fundamental part.
Several studies have shown that the brain and digestive system are closely linked. In fact, the enteric nervous system, which regulates our gut, often referred to us as our second brain, has about 100 million neurons, which is more than the spinal cord or the peripheral nervous system, using more than 30 neurotransmitters just like the brain. Is that right, Peter?
Yeah, it seems quite correct.
Okay. Also, 90% of the body's serotonin is found in the gut. So there's a lot of communication between these two major nerve centers. Professor Cryan, as a neuroscientist and an expert on the gut-brain axis, perhaps the most exciting area of science today, what are the pathways known to date that connect this kind of three-dimensional axis, the brain, the gut, and the microbiome?
Well, that's a really important question. And it's one that my laboratory is really focused on right now, trying to understand the relative contribution of the various pathways. So you mentioned the enteric nervous system, and that's a part of a neural pathway that we have. We know that the microbes are able to interact with this enteric nervous system, probably indirectly, but are supposed to modulate that. And this enteric nervous system can actually then talk to another nerve, which is called the vagus nerve. Now, vagus, it comes from the Latin for wandering, very similar to other words like vagrant and vagabond. But this wandering nerve sends signals from all of our peripheral organs, and then particularly our gut, all the way to the brain, and helps us how we feel. So we know that the enteric nervous system onto the vagus is really important. We showed well over a decade ago now that when in the experimental studies, when we cut the vagus nerve, all of the effects of a specific bacteria were gone. And so, as I like to remind people, this tells us that what happens in vagus doesn't stay in vagus.
I'm glad someone is confirming that.
Will actually affect our emotions in different ways. So that's the neuronal route. The second route is through the immune system. For many centuries, we thought that our immune system, that our brain was immunoprivileged and wasn't able to receive immune signals. But that's been all countered over the last 3 decades or more. And we know that the microbiome can shift the peripheral immune system, and that can then talk to the brain in different ways. And that's a really good way of interaction. Third way is through various hormonal signals that are being released in response to the microbiome. And we're learning a lot more now about the importance of these hormones in gut-brain signaling. Things like GLP-1, which is the hormone on which Ozempic and such drugs work on, this is released from the gut and acts on the brain. So now it's becoming less of a mystery overall, but we know the microbiome can shape the release of certain hormones in particular. And then finally, it's worth noting that our microbes are like a little factory producing all kinds of weird and wonderful chemicals that our bodies wouldn't have otherwise. And these chemicals, some of them can get into the systemic circulation and cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain itself. So they're the four major pathways at play. There are other factors as well, but understanding how they work in tandem with each other and at different time points across the lifetime and how they vary across health and disease. That's a big part of what we're trying to disentangle.
Oh, I really like this complexity. Dear Ceci and John, I fully agree. And I'm getting more and more excited the more I hear what you are saying, that you both decided to cover this field. Traditionally in my life as a neuroscientist and neurosurgeon, I was focusing mainly on the brain-heart axis, where we are doing quite an amount of research after stroke or after intracerebral hemorrhage. But over the time, it has become clear that many organs seem to communicate bidirectionally with the brain. The gut as an organ is here of distinct interest, as Ceci mentioned before. It has its own nervous system, the autonomous nervous system, and thus one might think that the gut acts independently from the brain, which is not correct as we understand today. However, the concept that microbes in the gut, basically the inhabitants of the organ, interact with the brain is both fascinating and, I would say, really novel. I should say that the insider scientists have been working in this area for quite some time. And John, you are one of the experts helping to unravel this axis. So could you, as the expert, give us some insight into the anatomical basis of the gut-brain axis, how the gut and the brain interact together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of these pathways, how they're anatomically laid out is very important. Basically, if we think about it from the vagus nerve, and it's one of the cranial nerves, that, you know, it's really important sensor of what's going on within our various organs, and it helps the brain to appreciate these internal milieu of the gut and other organs. It also helps to integrate signals from multiple organs at the same time and really will enable changes in heart rate, changes in breathing, all of which are under vagal control and are very much anatomically laid down. The other part of the puzzle is remembering that this is, and we've been interested in, is looking at this across evolution as well, because, you know, these signals begin early on, and we're beginning to appreciate that in our model organisms, whether it's in C. elegans, the worm, in Drosophila, the fruit fly, in zebrafish, that they all have mechanisms that the microbiome biome can actually signal and change behavior. And that, to me, is quite startling, helping us to understand that this anatomical link is evolutionary wired. And we're beginning to learn how important this is. But as I like to remind people, it's worth remembering that the microbes were there first. And so there never has been a time where our anatomy has existed without these microbial signals. So we have evolved to be able to respond to such signals and basically co-evolved to work in tandem with them.
I really like how you put the cranial nerves, not only the vagal nerve, obviously, but also the other cranial nerves onto the stage, bringing all these inputs.
And before we ask the next question, let's listen Mexican-Canadian artist Rafael Lozano Hemer, known for his incredible large-scale interactive installations with a science fiction field, talk about the story behind an installation he created in 2018 called Double.
So Double is basically a representation of the DNA of two creatures. On the one hand, the creature is the influenza bacterium. So it used to be that we used to think that influenza was caused by a bacterium, which is now no longer an accepted idea. But this bacterium was the very, very first living entity that had all of its DNA sequenced. So we knew from the beginning to the end what the DNA of this bacterium was. So when you look at this artwork, what you see is the bacterium's DNA, kind of like a broth that's flowing. And then line by line, it starts writing the genetic code of the bacterium. So AGCT, AGCT, so on. And then there's a second moment, a second screen, where you have another creature's DNA, and it happens to be my DNA. So I got my DNA sequenced. And it writes the code, again, GTCA, whatever, it's slow. What I really like about this is that these are biodetermined portraits of two creatures. And it's almost impossible to know which one's me and which one is the bacterium. I like the idea that the instructions, the fundamental instructions of life, are the same for that creature than for me as a human.
So one of the major killers and causes of disability currently is stroke. That's what I deal quite a fair amount in my clinical practice. And the large complex stroke research is, roughly speaking, not only about treating the brain after stroke, but also about stroke prevention, protection of the brain in the acute stroke setting, and also fostering the rehabilitation in the subacute setting. So how can we improve on the regenerative capacity of the individual patients? Now, there is super exciting data out there that the microbiota and the gut are capable to modulate the repair of the integrity of injured blood vessels and the neurovascular unit. And when I say neurovascular unit, I mean the interaction of the endothelial cells with the surrounding cells and the blood-brain barrier. And the microbiota and the gut also have an influence on the brain's innate immune system, which is important for damage control and rehabilitation. So can you speculate on what we might be able to learn from this research and apply to the future treatment of acute stroke patients, or maybe even other brain injured patients and those recovering from these injuries?
It's a really important question. Now, I'm not a stroke researcher, so I should start by saying that, but I have been following the fields very well, and the parallels that you draw there are not so different to many of the other disorders in psychiatry and neurodegeneration that we do study. So I can comment with some ease. What we know is that the composition of the microbiome is beginning to be seen as something that might influence outcome for stroke in the first instance. And that may be driven by its role on gating neuroinflammatory processes. So that's becoming quite clear, especially in experimental models. People have shown very much that perturbations of the microbiome can worsen stroke outcome in experimental models. And I think that is also may give rise to some of the inter-individual differences we see in stroke outcomes, because that's a big part of the stroke story, is trying to understand why certain people have much worse outcomes than others. There is a part in the preventive mechanism, which you mentioned, which is also related around cardiovascular risk, because we know that the ability to form atherosclerotic plaques in general and various other risk factors is also regulated by the microbiome. And we know that certain dietary substances, you know, like L-carnitine, are broken down into somewhat toxic factors like trimethylamine oxide, which is a microbial metabolite, which can lead to the buildup of plaques in the first instance. And then in relation to post-neuroinflammation and into overall outcome and effect on the penumbra and various aspects there, it is really important to understand that the signals from the microbiome are wired to affect many aspects of oxidative stress and bioenergetic metabolism within the brain that are going to be really important for the release of various neurotransmitters like glutamate that will worsen outcome as well. So slowly we're beginning to look at that. I'm beginning to see more and more that anywhere in biomedicine where we have inter-individual differences at play, that there is potentially a role for the microbiome to play a key role there. What we need is much more better human data to back up all of the really exciting work that's happening in experimental animals. And then finally, as you mentioned, the neurovascular unit and in relation to blood-brain barrier in general, we and others have shown that the integrity of the blood-brain barrier is sensitive to these microbial signals and that we can harness the microbiome in ways to protect the blood-brain barrier from certain insults. And we've shown, for example, lipopolysaccharide, which is an inflammatory insult, can be protected by certain microbial metabolites. So a lot of the puzzle is coming together before in the acute stroke and in the outcome. And perhaps then with rehab aspects and neurorehabilitation, we know that the microbiome is sensitive to various other motor effects like exercise, etc. And there may even be a role there that hasn't been really fully realized to my knowledge at this stage.
Talking about the immune system, according to the 2023 American Society for Dermatologic Surgery annual meeting, the skin and the gut microbiome may be associated with developing or protecting against skin cancer, as well as responding to cancer treatment. So since the composition of the microbiome, as you were mentioning, Professor Cryan, may play a role in the development of many problems, and in this case, skin cancer, does this mean that changing the composition of the microbiome may help to cure the patient? And if so, how can you drastically and quickly change someone's gut microbiome?
You're tapping into some of the most exciting areas of microbiome science, which is at that interface of oncology, and perhaps the one where we might see the closest clinical translation in the coming years. And of course, yes, as you mentioned, melanoma is where this has been looked at. I think the issue isn't as much about whether the microbiome is driving the cancer per se, but what the data is really showing us is that the composition of a microbiome will influence the efficacy of certain medications, in particular checkpoint inhibitors, which are these new chemotherapeutic agents that are really changing oncology treatment. And indeed, it has been shown that if you could switch the microbiome of an individual who wasn't responding, that they were able to make them respond. And they did this through fecal microbiome transplants. So this is taking someone else's poo. That's one way, but there are other dietary ways that people can rapidly shift the microbiome. People have shown by rapidly changing the fiber intake, and you can also change the microbiome quite quickly. So these are proof of concept studies and really telling us that how drugs work in the body may be really dependent on the overall microbiome of an individual.
Just previously, you stressed that the microbiome was first, and it seems that it's even there before the brain develops. And in fact, you have done some experiments showing that the formation of the brain as an organ might be influenced by the microbiome. I read about or I've seen some of the examples of your research. You were studying the hippocampus, and hippocampus is important for memory and for epilepsy. You've studied the effect on the amygdala, which is playing some kind of role in anxiety of individuals. So what does that mean for today's neurologists, psychiatrists, and neurosurgeons treating developmental and neurocognitive disorders, let's say epilepsy? Do we need to rethink our therapeutic approaches, not only giving medication or cutting out the area that is firing?
It's a great question. And I think what the field has opened up in neurodevelopment, it tells us that most of our work is in model systems, but we've clearly shown in model systems that if you don't have appropriate microorganisms in your gut, your brain doesn't develop appropriately. But the brain is quite plastic, as you know, Peter. So we have opportunities and critical windows for intervention that we can actually change the microbiome to rebalance maybe some of this dysfunctional signaling that's going to occur. I think it opens up huge opportunities. I think already we're seeing this being harnessed by a variety of infant food companies and various people like that trying to make powerhouse type of infant formula. But I think it just allows us to show that also from a public health understanding that having appropriate, diverse diet that's good for your microbiome, and we can talk about what that means, but it's going to be really important early in life. And from a public health point of view, from our understanding of early childhood development, this is going to be really important. In relation to therapies, we are beginning to see this being investigated a little bit more, but we need a lot more data. And I think that's where we're going to be. You mentioned epilepsy, and epilepsy may be seen as too extreme of a case, but you know, we already treat some epilepsies with diet, the ketogenic diet, and experimental work in animals from Elaine Chow's group in Caltech or UCLA has shown that the efficacy of a ketogenic diet in epilepsy is maybe at least in part due to changing the microbiome of the gut. So again, it's already giving us something new to add on to the armamentarium of medications. It will probably never replace, but it is definitely something as an adjunct approach.
Peter, you just mentioned individual anxiety, and that reminded me of an article I read about a new study of your lab, Professor Cryan, that suggests a strong link between a healthy gut microbiome and a greater resilience to stress. Could you talk a little bit about how the gut microbiome is linked to how we deal with stress and what are the different forces in our daily lives that could have a direct impact on the microbiota?
That's a great question too. So daily stresses, again, we respond to them in a very different way, depending on our genetics, depending on our upbringing, depending on our social circumstances, depending on our environmental aspects. We showed now some years ago that if animals were raised in a stressful environment, that when they grew up, they had this increased stress response and that they had a change in their microbiome. That was kind of a foundational study for us, because then we showed, as other groups had previously, that if you take out the microbiome in mice, that they have an exaggerated stress response. So that's really cool as well. So now the microbiome is regulating stress. Stress is regulating the microbiome. And that led us to the idea, then what if we treated animals with specific strains of bacteria? Could we dampen down the stress response? We could. Then we went to humans and we said, could we do the same in a healthy control population that we bring into the laboratory and really nice ethical ways of stressing people? And we could show that happening. And so we're beginning to see that more and more the volatility of our daily lives is affecting the volatility of our microbiome, which is affecting how we deal with stress. And then more recently, in work that's just about to come out, we've shown also that the regulation of stress across the day is also under the control of the microbiome, and that there's a circadian aspect of it. So it's not maybe what you stress, but when you stress, that might be important and how the microbiome is regulating that. So this offers a whole opportunity to develop stress-busting strategies that would be targeting the microbiome.
How it was first discovered that the microbiome was involved in the brain and behavior?
Yeah, I think it all goes back to these mice that we call germ-free mice. I think that was one of the key findings, was work from Canada, from Jane Foster's group, from Rochelle's Heights in Karolinska in Sweden, and our own group, all at the same time had the same findings in these germ-free animals, that they have this dysfunctional brain development and alterations in the stress response. So I think that was one of the key findings. But even before that, we had ideas that, you know, certain bacteria, and we all know this from our daily lives, if you take a bacteria and it makes you feel sick, you feel stressed. That's part of sickness behavior in general. So the idea that bacteria could affect the brain, it was foundational in the field of psychoneuroimmunology. But in really getting clear evidence that the microbiome is really important for brain development and for stress development, that came from these germ-free mice.
I remember reading about this germ-free mice experiment that you conducted in your lab, where you witnessed some of social behavior changes Could you be so kind in talking a little bit about what changes did you witness in these mice?
Now, that was a very important discovery that we made. We showed that the animals, mice are like humans, so if you give them the chance to spend time with another mouse or an empty cage, they'll gravitate towards the mouse because they're social, but not if they're germ-free. And mice, perhaps like some humans, can be a bit fickle. So if you give them the chance to spend time with a new playmate versus their everyday playmate, they'll gravitate towards a new playmate, but not if they're germ-free. So they have social cognitive deficits and sociability deficits. And so that was really important. And then when we looked in their brains, this was coupled with changes at the level of the amygdala, changes in myelination patterns in the prefrontal cortex, region of the brain, very important in executive function and decision-making. And this was quite key to us because it began to tell us that there's something about the social brain in particular that makes it sensitive to signals from the microbiome. And then we've surveyed this across the entire animal kingdom. So whether it's a bumblebee in a hive or a baboon in the wild in Africa, when you start looking at when you change social hierarchies and social dynamics, you start to change the composition of the microbiome. And vice versa, if you start to change the microbiome, the one behavior that starts to come, no matter what type of animal you're looking at across the animal kingdom, it seems to be consistently a social behavior in particular.
That's super exciting. Reminds me of me as a neurosurgeon sometimes being antisocial. So I have to I have to think about my microbiota.
Maybe it's your microbiome.
Yeah, but if these germ-free mice are antisocial, I guess I should take care of more germs or more diverse germs. So the more diversity, the better. And how should I foster diversity in the gut?
Yeah, in general, in a very simplistic way, that's kind of the rule of thumb, is that like in all aspects of life, diversity is key and you want to try and do it. And studies have shown that the best way to increase diversity is to increase diversity in your diet. A rich diet that's quite diverse, especially in colors, driven by polyphenols and various other fibers and fermented foods, will enhance the diversity overall. You could have a diverse microbiome and have a diverse full of bad things as well. And we know that's the other aspect of diversity. So it's all context dependent.
And talking about diversity, which is a very nice subject, I'm delighted to introduce Ewan Shields, assistant conductor of the Halle Orchestra, whose excerpt I've chosen to draw a parallel between the need for diversity for a healthy gut microbiome and the rich tapestry of instruments needed in an orchestra and the magic that diversity creates. Let's listen.
The reason I became a musician in the first place was playing an orchestra for the first time and having a really transformative experience. I remember vividly every note and feeling like I was looking to the side and I felt connected to the cellist that was next to me, and I felt that the whole cello section was one unit, and I could see across the violin section and the conductor. And the fact that we come from very diverse backgrounds and we play different instruments, for example, the rich, deep, and dark sonority of the contrabassoon is completely contrasting from the brilliance and the clarity of a trumpet. But we all have to come together and put our sounds on top of each other and create something in harmony, which none of us can on our own, was something that was so exciting and profoundly moving.
Professor Crane, we were talking about the changing nature of the gut microbiome. As we age, there's also a hormonal decline and also a cognitive decline. And from what you've been saying, I infer that there's also a microbial decline. So does the microbial decline have a direct impact on aging?
Yeah, that's an important area. You know, it's something that we've been fascinated about. And indeed, your microbiome starts to lose diversity as we age. And this parallels changes in other aspects of brain function and also the aging body in general.
Let's bring a few details together. So if you say that the microbiome changes over with age and loses diversity, and we have just been talking about the role of the microbiome for hippocampus and its role for memory, if we assume that the older we get, the more we have neurocognitive decline and we have memory loss and sometimes even dementia, could the transfer of microbiota from young mice to old mice by fecal transplantation reverse this phenotype? Could we prevent memory decline or hippocampus degeneration in elderly mice, or vice versa? What would happen if you would transfer microbiota from old mice to young mice? Would that cause cognitive degeneration prematurely in the very young mice?
So that's a question that I actually explored a couple of years ago with the really talented German postdoc Marcus Boehm and my team. We wanted to see if this could be the case. So we took the microbiome from young animals, so 8-week-old animals, and we transplant them into old lab animals. So they're 22 months to 24 months old mice. And remarkably, absolutely remarkably, Peter, we were able to show that we completely rejuvenated the brain, the hippocampus in particular. We looked at the chemical composition of the hippocampus, and in these mice, it was completely rejuvenated. We also changed their behavior. We restored some of the cognitive deficits that were there. We countered the effects on anxiety and on some of the immune measures overall. And that was really remarkable. Other groups have shown this sense. Marco Prince's group in Freiburg and a group in the United Kingdom have also shown this. So it's really, I get very buoyed as a scientist to show this has been able to be reproduced. And then the opposite is what you said, which is taking old microbiome and giving it to young mice. The work out of Singapore has shown that, and in a couple of other groups have shown that already. So that's really helps to validate that the microbiome is causally related to brain aging. And I think that's, you know, fascinating. And then with my colleague Yvonne Nolan here in Cork, what Yvonne did was take the microbiome from Alzheimer's patients and give it to healthy, normal rats. And she was able to show that by doing that, you were able to recapitulate some of the clear Alzheimer's-induced deficits in the hippocampus. So this is amazing, you know, to really show you can transfer Alzheimer's in such a way. And we always talk about it as a non-communicable disease, but maybe we may need to rethink that.
And that's amazing. Professor Cryan, meaning that through fecal transplants, I mean, I've read that the donor is very important, and that people being thin, if you take the transplant, the fecal from these people, then the person receiving it will also get thin, for example. That's I read. And is it possible to have a personality transplant?
You know, it's a great question. It's only been shown anecdotally. It was shown in a documentary on Netflix called Hack Your Health. They showed this person became depressed after taking a microbiome from their individual. But that's all anecdotal. I think we need more data to show, can this be looked at? People like a group in Canada are doing this in bipolar illness, and I'm collaborating with groups in Australia who started to look at the feasibility of doing this in major depression. I think we need more data. In summary, yes, it's possible, but we need data.
For our next question, and to give our listeners a bit of background, we're going to hear a brief overview of CRISPR and RNA technology.
Nobel Prize laureates Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer A. Doudna discovered a key gene technology tool, the CRISPR-Cas9 genetic scissors. These let researchers change the DNA of animals, plants, and microorganisms very precisely. This technology is changing the life sciences. It is helping to develop new cancer therapies and could help to cure inherited diseases. Humans have DNA and RNA. DNA is our genetic material. It is found in the chromosomes in cell nuclei and contains the code for making all the body's proteins. RNA is created specifically for protein synthesis and has functions such as coding, decoding, regulating and expressing genes. It is found in both the nucleus and cytoplasm and makes up about 5% of a human cell, while DNA makes up about 1%. Many of these RNA elements exist in nature, but can also be created. This makes RNA an important part of the rapidly developing field of synthetic biology. It can be used to silence target gene expressions via RNA interference. Finally, expressions of shRNA in cells are typically accomplished by delivery of plasmids, or trough viral or bacterial vectors.
Dr. Dean Radin is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Science, IONS, and his company, Congenetics, is at the forefront of developing RNA-based therapeutics that are revolutionizing the treatment of psychiatric disorders. Congenetics has developed a vector for CRISPR-Cas9 and shRNA that is delivered through the nose to target the HTR2A gene for the treatment of chronic anxiety and age-related cognitive decline. Well, Dr. Radin left a question for you, Professor Cryan.
My name is Dean Radin. Professor Cryan, I was very enthusiastic to see that one of your research interests is applying novel approaches to facilitate drug and siRNA delivery to the brain in vivo. That's one of my interests as well. So my question is, what delivery systems are you considering for delivery of genetic edits to the brain, and what disorders are you targeting?
Well, this is tapping into one of my, you know, longstanding interests in trying to do target validation in the brain in the first instance, and then to try and move towards therapeutic opportunities. So my lab was one of the first to do non-viral in vivo knockdown of siRNA in the mouse brain over 20-something years ago. siRNA revolution came out. And when I moved to Cork, I started working with a collaborator here, Katrina O'Driscoll, who works on cyclodextrin-based delivery vectors. And so for some years, we've been working on trying to harness these cyclodextrins to get them across the brain barrier. And the disease we focused on most was Huntington's disease, because we see it as a prototypical genetic disease, that there is no other approach really that was going to work outside of a genetic approach. And so we've shown some success in this approach in animal models of Huntington's. The big issue is trying to get these non-viral vectors to be able to cross the blood-brain barrier at concentration sufficient, and then using various targeting tools, whether it's transferring, etc., to get across. But it's a really exciting and important area, because many of these genetic brain disorders have no other opportunity without having these genetic systems.
And going back to stress, prenatal stress can affect brain function and how we respond to stress for several generations. In guinea pigs, for example, the effects of the mother's diet during pregnancy on the HPA, or hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and the heart can be seen in the second and third generations. In humans, early stress can also affect the health of children and grandchildren. And I recently came across a very interesting paper on grandmother's exposure to violence. It was done by a collaboration of universities in Brazil, Sweden, and Germany, and I will include the link to this paper in the description of this episode. They were testing methylation, I believe that's how you pronounce it, a universal biomarker in the DNA of grandmothers and grandchildren in saliva. They were able to show how stress can affect neurodevelopment, mental health, and risk of psychiatric disorders. In this case, post-traumatic stress and depression. Professor Cryan, you talked earlier about not just our genes, but our microbial genes, so to say. And I have two questions. Are there any studies of how stress during pregnancy affects the microbiome of the mother and grandmother, and how this might affect the child's social or psychiatric development?
So this is a really important area in biological psychiatry in general, understanding these epigenetic factors that are at play. And indeed, as you correctly surmise that there would be, there is a growing body of work, both in animal models and in humans, in looking at particular women who have had high perceived stress during pregnancy. You can already detect changes in the microbiome in the offspring. In our animal models, we're able to look at this in more detail and look at the long-lasting epigenetic changes, such as the methylation patterns that you mentioned, and how they can be to then transmitted on to other generations. People are readily investigating this as well. So I think it adds one other layer of complexity to the puzzle on this. We should point out that for the most part, well, the humans and mammals are sterile in utero. So it's the stress is affecting the mother's microbiome and the metabolites that they produce that can cross the placenta and induce these long-term enduring effects. So it's also happening at that level. And then finally, it's not all about the mother, and we should be important to point that. There's a really, really intriguing study out from EMBL Rome this year in Nature, where they showed that the father's microbiome influenced the epigenetic regulation and how that transmitted into future generations as well in mice. And so here you have the microbiome influencing paternal epigenetic effects, which is really wouldn't have been predicted. And it's really a state-of-the-art study.
And I'm also curious about births by C-section versus vaginal births. Of course, C-sections have saved lots of lives, but thinking about those C-sections performed by choice, I've always thought of C-sections as a kind of physical shock of being taken out of the womb suddenly. Do C-sections affect the baby's microbiome and therefore perhaps social behavior later in life?
Yeah, it's really an intriguing finding. You could argue that you mentioned the word that it's like a physical shock of being taken out, but it actually could be the opposite. It could be removing the actual stress of being born vaginally. And that stress is really good for us and helping us prime for future stress exposure later in life. So it's difficult to know, but to answer your question, yes. And we've shown this in our animal models, but it's also been shown in multiple cohort studies in humans that if you're born by C-section, you do not get the vertical transfer of microbes to the same level from your mom overall. And you get a microbiome that's more akin to the hospital environment, for example, or the home environment. And therefore, these bacteria are going to be quite different and going to inform the developing immune system quite different. And at least in our animal models, we found that they are leading to social deficits in later life. And in our humans, we did a small study in humans where we stratified people, whether they were born by C-section or not. And we showed that those born by C-section had an exaggerated stress response when we test them for stress parameters in the lab. You know, so a lot more work needed, but I echo your thoughts that C-section is a life-saving, important surgical intervention in many, many patients. But with C-section rates skyrocketing, I think it's an important public health message that we get out there that there may be some unintended consequences in a non-essential way.
John, you wrote a book with Scott Anderson and Ted Dynan called The Psychobiotic Revolution, Mood, Food and the New Science of the Gut-Brain Connection. Could you briefly explain to the audience what psychobiotics, and they obviously play an essential role in your book, are and what the revolution is that you talk about in that book?
Great. Well, psychobiotics is a term we coined here in Cork. Ted Dynan, he's retired now, but he was the former chair of psychiatry here, and he was my partner in all my pursuits. So it's always great to have a clinical colleague in this. And we coined this term psychobiotic to be, initially we had a very narrow, just to be bacteria that when taken in adequate amounts can confer a mental health benefit. But we expanded it really to be any microbiome targeted intervention that will support mental health. And that allows us to think about things like prebiotics and fibers and fermented foods that we know are good for the microbiome. It also thinks about combinations of both. It also allows for fecal transplants if they would fit into that armamentarium. And the revolution, well, that was the title that our publishing house changed it to. I think it's a bit early, but you know, every revolution needs to begin somewhere. And when we have a situation where in our medical schools today, and I work in one, where our students get almost no training in nutrition or in relation to diet effects on health, our dentists get more, which is scary. And this is universal, that I think it is important that we say we need a revolution to really get people to understand that the importance of the microbiome is in all aspects of health, but in particular in relation to mental health. And I think that's an important message to get across. We spend so much time in medicine talking about genetics, when really all you can do with genetics at the end is blame your parents and your grandparents. With your microbiome, it is really potentially modifiable and offers our patients agency over their own healthcare in ways that we would never have dreamed of. So it's an early revolution, and I hope it can lead to some changes in how we think and contextualize brain health.
Okay, I think that makes sense. And it stresses again the role of diet and how diet can change the gut microbiome. So for our listeners, mainly the lay listeners, just a quick recipe. What do you recommend? What are the main factors that keep us from having a healthy microbiome, and how can we change that?
Yeah. So there's things we can do. There's things we can add to our diet so we can really increase the amount of fermented foods and fiber overall. So this is the prebiotic. So both fermented foods, you know, in some places the culture isn't as strong. In Ireland, it's really poor, but in parts of Germany, it's much stronger. But like things like kombucha, kefir, kimchi, the three Ks, as I call them, are really good. But also yogurts and sauerkraut and various other things are really good, and the fermented foods. But fibers are king. If you can tolerate fibers, that's really good. Polyphenols, these will give a lot of our vegetables color. Anything with color is really good, just simplistically. But also these polyphenols are in nuts and in aspects of red wine in small moderation. Also grape juice will just as good. And then we also know that omega-3 fatty acids are also good for the microbiome. Then on the negative side, things to avoid, which is really the things that are found within processed foods like sweeteners and preservatives. The ultra processed foods in particular have been shown to be really negative for the microbiome. In general, we should try and support breastfeeding as much as possible. It is absolutely amazing for the infant's microbiome, and that's really important. We should increase our public health literacy around C-section, as we talked about, and we should try and avoid stress. The sleep field is beginning to wake up to the microbiome, and we really begin to see a lot of interactions between good sleep and the microbiome. We also encourage aerobic exercise in the microbiome. It's really important there. And then I guess, finally, one that my kids were delighted when I told them was that having a pet, particularly having a dog, is shown to be really good for your microbiome. So that's another practical aspect.
Well, it seems that the industrialized world has a lot to do with problems with a healthy composition of a gut microbiota. You got the consumption of ultra-processed foods, you got the increase of C-sections, and then on top of that, it also seems to be poorer in terms of diversity than sedentary lifestyles, sleep deprivation. And then with age, the more industrialized the country, the greater the tendency towards isolation. I mean, we're toast in the Western world, and I think we better change our ways.
Change our ways, also for our patients, I think. From what I've learned now, microbiota also affects some of the diseases I like to take care of, so, and helps patients to rehabilitate. So really, we should maybe also look to other countries, nations that stick to more traditional and more natural foods and maybe compare how they do, whether they do better.
Unfortunately, we have come to the end of our interview, Professor John Cryan and Professor Vaikatsi. You're both highly respected in the medical and scientific community and are known for your commitment to the scientific method. And also, your curiosity knows no bounds. You're always looking beyond neurology to explore its connections with other subjects. And it is just minds like yours that drive scientific progress. So I would like to thank you, Professor Cryan, for your generosity in granting us this remarkable interview. And thank you, Peter, for your invaluable time and for being such a fantastic co-host. It was a pleasure and an honor to share this podcast with both of you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, for me, it's a super pleasure. I'm very glad and inspired, and thank you for having the opportunity to really co-host and co-moderate. And John, you were really a great partner to talk to, and I've learned a lot from you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you both.
If you're interested in learning more about the gut microbiome and follow Professor Cryan and his amazing scientist Team Step at University College in Cork, do not forget to check this episode's description. And if you want to take charge of your gut and optimize your mind, you simply have to read The Psychobiotic Revolution, Mood, Food, and the New Science of the Gut-Brain Connection. It's an accessible read that will radically alter the way you think, among many other conditions, such as anxiety and depression. Or watch him in Netflix, a new documentary, Hack Your Health. To all our listeners, thank you, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. And see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button.